Back at it once again, new week, Monday, May 11th, right here on Connecticut Today. Our buddy Mark Fitch joined us early in the show to talk about a gaping hole that's getting even wider in the Connecticut State Teacher Pension and Retirement Program. We carried some of the remarks, as usual, of Governor Ned Lamont, his coronavirus update, and Scott Dolch joined us for a return visit in the 5 o'clock hour. Scott runs the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Many restaurants look to at least reopen partially on May 20th. Scott gave us his thoughts on that target date. Welcome back. One of our main contributors to the program here, Mark Fitch of the Yankee Institute. He writes the Fitch Files column, but today Mark's back because the Institute is highlighting something that should be of big concern to taxpayers, and especially if you are a teacher here in Connecticut looking at the pension fund maybe down the road a few years or maybe not. And Mark is with us. Mark, how are you today on a Monday? How you doing?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm socially distant. I'm here in the beautiful Wallingford Bureau because we all know Wallingford is the center of the universe. I'm sure you people at the Yankee Institute already know that. But
I'm also socially distant, sitting in my room, watching the storm outside.
Nice. Yeah, one rolled through here. Yeah, listen, you know, as we sit here and we eat our macaroni and cheese and wait for this whole thing to pass by. You folks at the Institute, Mark, you've highlighted a study that was done by someone taking a look at the hard numbers regarding the state's teacher pension program. Talk a little about that. First of all, for people who are not teachers and who might not understand this program, give us a little base knowledge here of what this centers around.
Oh, well, this is, you know, so Connecticut has a separate pension fund for all teachers. So, you know, your town teachers that, you know, teach your kids at your local school, you know, your local Board of Education pays them, but when they retire, they receive a pension through the state of Connecticut. It's called the Connecticut Teachers Retirement System.
Mm-hmm.
And that retirement system is badly underfunded in that we don't have enough money to pay all the claims that are coming down the road. And it's something that, you know, we at Yankee Institute have looked into a lot. And we just put out a study today showing that the way that they're calculating the pension funding may not be completely accurate, and that the pension fund itself might be in a lot more debt than the state has told us in the past.
How, Mark, generally is the money put in the fund? Physically, who pays what, where, when, how, and why? How does this work?
So over the course of their career, a Connecticut teacher will pay 7% of their income into the pension fund,
mm-hmm.
and the state pays an additional about 27% of, you know, kind of matches 27% of their income to go into that pension fund. And teachers, they in that respect, I mean, they get a pretty good pension payout. I think the average is about $60,000 a year. But they're also not eligible for Social Security. So it's something that Yankee has advocated to change. So they essentially forego Social Security in exchange for this pension.
Interesting. And the foregoance of Social Security, is that cleared on the federal level? So in other words, the feds are okay with not paying into the Social Security fund, not having that tax taken out of their check? Is that how it works?
Oh yeah, we've done this, you know, for a long, long time. You know, the teachers don't pay into it, and they don't receive it either. So,
are there other states, Mark, that do that? Is that a popular way of funding a pension for teachers around the country or not?
There's a few states that do it that way. A lot more states. Other states do allow them to collect Social Security. Some states have, you know, teachers have to pay more into their pensions. Some states they do more of a 401k style retirement.
Mm-hmm.
So it varies state to state. But in Connecticut, yeah, they don't pay into Social Security, and they don't receive it after they retire. So pretty much their entire retirement is hinging on this state-run program. And unfortunately, the state has not been running it so well. We're looking at a $17 billion unfunded liability. And that's the state's numbers. Our study that just came out says that that number might be closer to $50 billion. It depends on how you measure the money that's in there and how you measure what the state expects to get back when it invests those pension funds in the stock market.
So the average taxpayer, Mark, might be listening to you right now. Maybe that taxpayer may be a teacher. Who knows? And the first question they're probably going to ask is, hey, wait a minute, Mark Fitch, why is there such a variance there? And if I am a teacher, am I going to end up getting screwed in the end? And if I'm a taxpayer, am I going to end up getting screwed because I'm going to have to make up the difference of what's not there?
Well, I mean, the taxpayers are already doing that because a vast majority right now, the state pays about $1.2 billion per year towards a pension fund, just to keep it going. About 95% of that is to pay off these unfunded liabilities. So the taxpayer is already getting hosed. The teachers, on the other hand, they have had to contribute more. Just a couple years ago, they increased their pension contribution from about 6% to 7%. And so they're already having more money taken out to try to support this. So in the end, you know, moving forward, the annual cost, so we're going to go from $1.2 billion to about $1.6 billion per year to pay for this stuff. That's going to come from somewhere. It might come from the taxpayers. It might come from the teachers. It might come from service cuts in other parts of the budget. And we have to remember, we're facing an entirely different world now than we were 6 months ago, because now with the pandemic and the market downturn, we're looking at, you know, $2 billion deficits going forward. Mm-hmm. So the state is out of money, and the cost of these pensions keeps going up, and the money is going to have to come from somewhere. So this is going to put, you know, the governor is going to put the lawmakers in a tough spot. And one of the things that we've highlighted in this study is the fact that even though we've been paying every year the full amount that the pension fund supposedly needs, the unfunded liabilities keep going up. So we went from, in 2008, we had about $5 billion in unfunded liabilities, according to the state's report. And 10 years later, we're looking at $17 billion. And that's with us making the full payments every year. So
and
clearly
and why is
not
that
working?
But why, yeah, okay, so that was going to be my next question before we take a break. Somebody's going to hear that, Mark, and they're going to say, well, wait a minute. If everybody's paying what they're supposed to be paying, which is what you said, why isn't this working? Where's the sand in the gears here, Mark, that's causing the numbers not to add up?
Yeah, and that has to do with what we call the discount rate. So Connecticut assumes that we're going to make 6.9% on our market investments for the pension fund. And because we assume that, we pay 6.9% less in our annual payments. Now, that sounds right, unless the market goes down. And we know the market went really down in 2008, and we know the market's going to go really down this year. You know, so we're not going to get those expected returns, and that compounds over time. So essentially, because we have a discount rate that's too high, we're not paying in enough. It looks like we are, but we're not. And we can see that because the liability keeps growing, even though we've been making our full payments. So it's something that has to be fixed, but I don't even know if we're going to be able to do it, because if you lower the discount rate, you have to increase the amount of money the state is putting into that pension fund. And let's face it, we're out of money at this point. So we're kind of in a catch-22 with these pensions. And it's going to come back and probably bite everybody at some point in the very near future.
the website yankeeinstitute.org. They're also on Twitter and Facebook, the Yankee Institute for Public Policy here in Connecticut. Mark Fitch joins us, as he often does. Okay, so Mark, there's this growing gap now between what we can pay and what we owe and what should be paid out from this Connecticut Teachers Pension Fund. Everybody's making their payments, as you say, ostensibly, but the hole keeps getting bigger. How do you fix this? I mean, is this the kind of thing where you go back to the teachers' unions and you say, do we change the payout? Do we restructure this? That's the part I'm not getting. Is this fixable at all?
Well, you know, one of the problems is I doubt that they'd be able to deduct enough from a teacher's pay to fix this, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, the last time they increased the teacher's contribution, they went from 6% to 7%. That would have added $30 million each year to the pension fund. But you know what they did with it is they took that money and spent it instead. So the teachers paid more, but it didn't actually go into the pension fund. And, you know, that's kind of a recurring problem in Connecticut. You know,
when you mean spent it, Mark, who spent it on what? What do you mean exactly?
It was the legislature. They increased. Yep. So that extra $30 million that the teachers ended up paying through the 1%, you know, increase in what comes out of their paycheck just went into the general fund.
Did the teachers complain about that, Mark? Did they know about that?
Yes, they did. You know, I think, you know, it probably would have been reasonable if it went into the pension fund, but it didn't. So it ended up just kind of being a tax in some form or another, you know. Massachusetts teachers pay much more into their pension fund. I think they pay 11%. You know, Connecticut's at 7. So, I mean, obviously, compared to our neighbors, there is some room to move there.
Yeah.
The study author, you know, recommends, well, you know, you can assume that you're going to get 6.9% off the stock market, but you shouldn't base your payments on that because it's too risky.
Yeah.
So you should lower your discount rate so that you're paying more into the pension fund. And then if you make your rate of return that you're expecting, great. You know, everything kind of improves. You know, like I said before, the trouble with that now is that, you know, that means you have to pay into it more. And Connecticut is out of money at this point. You know, we got a $1 billion deficit this year, 2.3 next year, 2 after that, you know. And we had already been looking at smaller deficits, but now with the pandemic, it's increased quite a bit. So
yeah.
this is a tough spot. This is like I said, it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, I'd be pretty upset, Mark, if I was a teacher. And back to that number, that 6.9% rate of return, Mark, that you say they were betting on. Look, I know hindsight can be 20/20 always in investing, but you know, was that rate of return, you know, 6.9, let's round it up to 7%, was that too pie in the sky? Was it not cautious enough? And who decided that rate? Where did that come from? Do you know?
So the 6.9% is actually relatively new. Up until 2016, it was 8.5%, and then Governor Malloy facilitated it being dropped down to 8%, and then Governor Lamont facilitated it being dropped down again to 6.9%.
Wow.
That's set by the Teachers Retirement Board in consultation with the state treasurer and the governor.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So they look at it and say what can be reasonable, and they probably project out. Okay. Well, so Mark, I mean, listen, the COVID-19 thing is keeping us all clamped down here, but eventually, maybe in a month or two, you know, we still have to get the legislature going some way, you know, by the state constitution. It's got to meet for some time, at least, you know, before the 2020 election cycle. Is this something that you think gets put, Mark, on the back burner to the longer session after the year turns and we get into 2021, only because of the virus and all that?
Yeah, I mean, this is not something they're going to try to tackle right now. I mean, Governor Lamont has said that he's going to try to talk to the state employee unions to see, you know, what they could possibly do as far as, you know, helping out with the budget situation. As far as the teacher pensions, that's something. Now, teacher pensions can be changed by the legislature. They do have that ability. It's mm-hmm. it's a very politically difficult move. Because you have, you know, you upset teachers, and, you know, the teacher unions are very strong, and they have a strong lobby. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that would be for a long session, you know, next year. This year, they are going to have to convene at some point to pass some kind of, you know, budget mitigation package, because we're looking at a $1 billion deficit this year. So I think it's probably just going to be the bare, you know, nuts and bolts of trying to make up for this difference. You know, as far as longer term things like, you know, the teacher pension and the state employee pension, that is going to be a long, hard fight for, you know, next session, I would say, if it comes up at all, you know, and that's part of the problem, is that, you know, as many times as we've put out these warnings saying that you're going to have a problem, this is going to come back to bite you, it constantly gets ignored. So they're getting to the point where they're not going to be able to ignore it anymore, because mm-hmm. we're going to have negative market returns. We're going to lose money on this, and that's going to cause the payments to increase as well.
That's even worse. And, you know,
yeah, it gets even worse with some kind of, you know, major economic downturn like this.
Yeah. Man, more tough stuff. Backed into a corner on this stuff. Got to run. Mark Fitch,
absolutely.
YankeeInstitute.org. Check it out. Check out the Fitch Files. Mark, as usual, we appreciate you coming on here and trying to explain all this. Mark, thanks. Be safe, and we'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Today and over the last few days, I think that basically the trend lines continue in a very positive direction, by which I mean the percentage who tested positive is now less than 10%. It's been less than 10% for a couple of days. And we'll see if that continues, but that's a good positive trend. I think there are about 31 states in the country that where it's less than 10% right now. 2 weeks ago, almost everybody was north of 10% positive testing. So I think that this gives you a trend of what's going on around the country. And for us, that's particularly important, since we're adjacent to New York, which still has a higher positive rating. And secondly, you'll see that the number currently hospitalized continues to go down, about 30 this time around. That gives you an idea of trend line. I think we're over at about 18, 19 days in a row with a three-day moving average. So that gives you an idea that May 20th is still on our horizon. The day-to-day change in hospitalizations, you can see it sort of goes back to more or less April 15th with a couple of little blips in there along the way. So it's worth keeping an eye on that. It's also, I'll tell you that folks being admitted to the hospital is really a top-line trend, not the net number. And there, let's say we were about 273 admitted a week ago. Yesterday was 152. So that's the top line number in terms of folks infected, serious, admitted to the hospital, going down. We've had about 5,400 total discharges to date. And finally, the positive test day to day is, you know, sort of interesting. You see it trending down. You see it trending down, finally under 10% a little bit, what that means. And that's in part what we see in Connecticut, but also the greater New York metro area. New York City went from an average of 12,000 positives a day to about 2,800 the last few days. So I think in terms of the metrics that we had in mind thinking about our May 20th beginning to reopen date, we're on track. But as I've said before, it's more than the metrics. It's also behavior. On the metrics, by the way, tomorrow we're going to really focus on the PPE, the inventory, how we're getting that distributed, and the testing protocol. You know, we've got some guideposts there before May 20th where we want to be. So we're going to be able to talk about that in some detail. Let me just talk about behavior a little bit, because that's something that we do control in a positive and a negative way. And I've been so proud of Connecticut over these last 2 months in terms of social distancing, the efforts we've made. And I think that by and large, we're staying true to what we've got to do in order to continue to keep that curve going down. But, you know, you look around the world, you look around the country, and there are some warning signs out there. You see that the R-naught, which is the infection rate in Germany, let's say Germany is a month ahead of us on this pandemic schedule, and they have great track and trace, really good testing, opened up the schools, R-naught went up to 1.3 again. They were below 1, which meant the number of people infected was going down. You know, something to keep an eye on. South Korea, nobody, you know, they brought their new infections down virtually to zero. And then you probably saw they had the nightclubs open, people started going back, and it wasn't Typhoid Mary, but it was Typhoid Tommy. And all of a sudden, went to three different nightclubs, and I think there were 60, 70 plus infections, and gives you an idea of how infectious COVID is and how fast it can move. We're hearing about the flare-ups in different parts of the country. Again, the trend lines are important, but in Marion, Ohio, a correctional facility on fire. Dallas, Texas, a nursing home, and what that meant there. Minnesota, one of the meatpacking facilities. So these flare-ups are something we watch very carefully, and that's why track and trace. Track and trace is like our fire department, right? We go after these flare-ups. We at least are able to contain them going forward. So we know that as we slowly and methodically reopen, we keep it under control. Another flare-up, which maybe took some folks by surprise, is at the White House. As you probably heard, at least two key you know, advisors or somebody took care of the president tested. So, you know, today we had our weekly briefing with the Vice President Pence's task force, and this time there wasn't 10 people sitting around a table in our teleconference from the White House. Instead, it was the vice president. He walked in with a mask, sat down, took off the mask in there, taking questions, giving a good update. Deborah Birx in another room separately. It just gives you an idea. Everybody else by Zoom. So everybody is taking the social distancing more seriously now, which I think is a very important trend. They gave us some good news as well, that the remdesivir, which is a therapeutic that can greatly reduce the harm caused by COVID, reduce your amount of time in the intensive care unit. We got our shipment to Connecticut, as well as other states did, went right to our hospitals. PPE, they are ramping up. As I've said before, the supply and demand are getting closer to equilibrium. And the shipment is going out next week directly to all of our nursing homes, just to give them now a little bit of inventory, a little bit more breathing room. They're also proud to talk about the new FDA approval for an antigen test, which is a little like the Abbott test. As you know, the Abbott test is the nose swab, and you can get a positive or negative reading in less than 15 minutes. Well, this is a lot easier to get the sample. This new antigen test that they're rolling out will have about 5 million samples a month, starting within a week or so. It also is a lot less expensive, which is important, something we're focused on as well, with a much lower you know, false positive rate. So this is all gives you an idea that there are some changes taking place which are positive. You know, on Thursday, again, we're going to have the reopen committee come and tell you about where we are in our protocols, where we are in terms of why we think the decisions we're making are there to keep you safe. Because this doesn't work unless, A, you are safe when it comes to a very methodical reopening. And just importantly, whether you are safe, you have to make sure that you feel safe. And, you know, that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit more to you today. We've got two people who are members of our reopen committee. Jan Hockadel, who many of you know, represents the teachers, represents the nurses, and Dave Roche, who represents the building trades and the folks who are out, you know, rebuilding our state. And they've been on our reopening committee, and they've been on that committee making sure that the folks they represent, making sure employees in general are taken care of and they're front and center in our attention in terms of what we got to do to make sure that we take care of people safely. You know, I want to make sure the store owners feel safe to open their store. I want to make sure the customers feel safe going back into the store. And I want to make sure everybody working at the store or the construction facility feels safe as well. I never really liked the name Reopening Committee because it's really not like we shut down the economy. As you know, two-thirds plus of the economy never closed down formally, but a lot of people just didn't feel safe going opening up that store or going into that store. As Jan knows, almost all of our schools closed down before we even gave an EO on that at all. And so we didn't close down the economy, and nor does government reopen the economy. We allow more stores to open. We encourage people to feel safe, and we give you the metrics to do it. But it's not until people feel safe that the economy will slowly come back into stride. And that's why I take the public health aspect of this so seriously. And that's why I take the safety of our employees, those going into the school, the hospital, the store, the building site, so, so seriously. So with that, I'd just like to ask Jan Hockadel to just talk for a few minutes about what she sees representing of the teachers and the nurses. Then Dave Roach will talk about the folks doing the building and take your questions. Jan?
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for all you're doing and for including us on your committee. I do also think it's really important that folks that are working on the front lines have a voice. And so for me, that means the educators, the healthcare workers, and the state employees. But I'm on the education subcommittee, so I'll focus there. Obviously, as you said, everyone has heard numerous times safety is our main concern. We've surveyed our educators several times. And when schools are reopened, teachers are not only concerned about their safety, but the safety of their students and everyone who works in the buildings. And they're also concerned about their families at home. We know that students and adults can be infected with the virus and not actually have symptoms, and then they would spread the virus to others. And that could include elderly relatives, members of the family that may be immune compromised. So there's definitely been a lot of discussion so far on how do we do this safely. And as we were mentioning this morning, educators would love to go back to the classroom. Our survey showed that teachers do not believe distance learning is an effective long-term method. Our students are facing too many obstacles, like parents that are not able to assist their child, the lack of supervision, those that are unable to keep up for various reasons, and one of them obviously being not enough skills or knowledge to utilize the online technology. So teachers are definitely telling me they would love to go back into the classroom, but the safety for themselves, their students, and their families have to come first. And of course, another topic we're discussing is the protections and protocols that must be in place, such as will there be testing? Will there be masks and PPE provided to students and staff? And how will that social distancing be handled? You know, what will transportation look like? Because we're going to have to limit the number of students on a bus, and they have to wear masks, and they're going to have specific seats. What is that all going to look like? And what will be the protocol if someone is showing the symptoms or is confirmed to have the virus? So these are the conversations that are happening, and we're making sure that our educators, administrators, superintendents, everyone in the school community has the ability to voice their concerns and their ideas. And right now we're looking at what camps and summer schools may look like. And of course, that framework will then be the basis for conversations looking forward into the fall. And in the fall, we're going to have to be flexible. You know, we can put a great plan in place, but we have to take into account, what are we going to do if a student or a teacher contracts the virus? And what are we going to do if the state has another surge? So a lot of things are being taken into consideration. And I think most workers in the state are very concerned about how they're going to do their jobs. I know the educators are worried about the resources for their jobs. And as you know, there's been a lot of talk about state and municipal budgets. Will they have the resources to be successful in education? Will art, music, and shop courses that keep many of our most at-risk students engaged be available? Will our paraeducators be protected so that they can support our most vulnerable students? But those are the same concerns that are being felt in hospitals and in state buildings also. What will jobs look like when we reopen the state? So, again, I mentioned this morning that most educators expect that school will look and feel different with a hybrid of in-person and distance learning, and they're concerned about how they will provide remediation and catch up for students in every grade level, especially for special education students, English language learners. But that could also be said for our hospitals and office buildings. How we work from now on is going to be different. But with the input from those on the front lines, we can weather this together and come out better. So thank you.
Well, thanks, Jan. And Jan's referring this morning to a live video conference that went out on CTN, which is maybe what you're on now. So you can watch that if you have any questions about what the educators had in mind. Dave?
Good afternoon, Governor. Thanks for having me on today. It's really a privilege to be able to sit on this committee and represent the workers of Connecticut, especially on construction sites, but all workers. You know, in the beginning, we were a little apprehensive when we found out job sites were going to stay open. As you know, Boston, New York closed a lot of theirs down, so we had some concerns. Job sites, as everybody knows, aren't the cleanest places in the world. You know, you have to use portalets, you have to not a lot of cleaning stations. So we felt there was going to be a lot of challenges to getting this done, but right out early, you signed Executive Order 7. We worked with your chief of staff, Paul Mounds. We were able to get some really good stuff into place early. And I think if you look at the overall infection rate on construction jobs, it was low. I know from the numbers I've taken from our members, we didn't get a lot of infections throughout the projects. When we did, we shut job projects down and got them disinfected early. So things worked out really well. As being part of the committee, what we're doing now is taking best practices. We use some from them areas like Boston, New York, what they're going to put in place. What we saw work for us, take them best practices, working with the committee to make sure that, you know, the things are going to change for us to keep everybody safe. We're going to have to get used to maybe staggered shift starting times, shift work more on the projects, you know, wash stations more throughout the projects. A lot of different things, you know, that are going to be put into place moving forward. And I think we're going to learn from, you know, the jobs that we're going and just keep everything moving in the right direction. I can tell you our members have been doing a great job of making sure they follow the guidelines, but we got to make sure that we have them in place going forward, make sure everybody keeps doing that. We don't want anybody to get lazy and start saying, okay, everything's good now. We don't need to have any more infections, and we want to get building Connecticut again like we should be.
Let's rebuild Connecticut. Thanks, David. Max, questions?
NBC Connecticut.
Hi, Governor. Matt Austin with NBC Connecticut. Last week, Josh had talked about a big PPE delivery that was supposed to happen this weekend. Did that, in fact, happen?
The answer is it did. A lot came in, and we're going to break that out for you tomorrow in some detail and have an announcement then.
And then just following up in terms of the businesses that will be expanding operations or reopening next week, will the state be helping those business owners acquire PPE so they can open safely?
Well, they are responsible for getting their own PPE. But that said, you know, we do have a backup plan. We've got via CBIA for those small businesses, we can get them the masks and other support they need if they can't get it themselves.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, this is a question for the panel, kind of following up on protecting the at-risk workers. You know, we're hearing from a lot of people, you know, in their 60s and older who are frankly kind of nervous about getting back to work. They don't want to go back, but they're kind of going back to work out of necessity. So what is your message to those workers? How are you going to protect them?
Want to start off with that, Jan?
Sure. I know that is a very major concern for many of our educators that might not be that old, but may have conditions that they just don't feel comfortable going back to work. And as I mentioned before, or may have someone at home that they're afraid that they may bring something back. So that's why I think it's so important that we get these plans right on how we're going to reopen, how we're going to protect our workers, and the people that they serve. And again, that doesn't just go for education, that goes across the board. I think we have to make sure everybody's has the proper protection so that they can keep safe.
Governor, anything else that you would like to add to that?
I would add that people over the age of 60, 65, I don't really want them going to work in the near term. People with pre-existing conditions should not be going to work. So we're going to have to figure out what is the right way to handle that given some of these learning situations. If they're a teacher and they can do a lecture because they're at a community college, there are other ways that they may be able to participate. But I think going to a public place where you're naturally liable to congregate is probably not a good idea, at least for the near term.
So do we think that they might be able to still kind of claim some of the unemployment benefits or something like that?
Yeah, we're looking into just that.
Thank you.
I want to spend some time talking with a gentleman that we've had here on the show a couple of times before pertaining to restaurants. Had nothing to do with the virus, but we were talking about minimum wage impact. We were talking about a little thing called the 20-80 rule as to how waiters and servers were getting paid. All that now secondary. And, of course, now Connecticut's restaurants told by or suggested to by Governor Ned Lamont and David Lehman and the rest of his reopening council on how to operate. Joining us right now, Scott Dolch, who heads the Connecticut Restaurant Association. Scott, good to have you back. How are you? I hope you're all safe and well. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, Scott, it seems like those other issues we were talking about were years ago, but I wanted to have you on because I know you, when these suggestions, whatever they are, guidelines, were released last week, I was wondering, I said, geez, I wonder what Scott thinks about this. And bingo, about an hour after I thought that, I saw you had put out a statement. And basically, before we talk about this a little more, Scott, what is the position of you with the Connecticut Restaurant Association and your some of your members, what you've heard from them about how the governor wants restaurants to reopen?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I'll start with the statement last week, kind of from the announcement from the governor and the reopen committee, which we actually do have a seat. We're fortunate to have a seat on that committee.
Yeah.
That May 20th will be an outdoor only opening option. And obviously, while we feel it is a step in the right direction, Paul, we also, you know there's a vast majority, a lot of our restaurants don't have patios, don't have outdoor dining. And obviously the ones that do, there's weather pertaining to it. There's a lot of challenges. And I think, you know, we've since the beginning have talked about, you know, following strict social distancing guidelines, but getting our economy back up and running, getting our restaurants back open. And we've kind of asked in our statement to say, hey, we can do outdoor and indoor with these strict guidelines to get us started and allowing every restaurant to have that opportunity. And that's kind of been, you know, our messaging. While we do feel it is a step beyond takeout and curbside, but we still feel, you know, we need to start to talk about how we get our businesses back open and every restaurant back open.
When you have voiced those concerns, Scott, have you gotten any blowback from the medical people or other people saying, hey, and I know they wouldn't put it this way, Scott, but have they said, hey, listen, calm your jets. We'll get to full restaurants soon enough. What has the response been by some of the things you've said?
Well, I think, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, and I take the stance, you know, we listen to public health. We've listened since the moment, you know, the governor on March 16th asked us told us to shut down our businesses. Obviously, you know, we know public health, it needs to be the number one priority, and we've been a part of that. But I also, you know, would say, as you look at opening other retail and everything else that's out there, you know, restaurants, we are leaders in safety and sanitation. There's no other industry that has public health go through their business quarterly, if not more so. There's no other industry that has to have the safety and sanitation guidelines that are put to the forefront. And from an industry perspective, we've tried to message that to the public health to say, listen, we can control our environment. We will continue to control our environment more so than we feel any other industry. And, you know, we will take the precaution, but we have to start to get these businesses that were told to close first. They've been hit the hardest. I mean, we're looking at, you know, on average 90% revenue drops for restaurants across the board. We have 8,500 of them in our state. We have 89,000 people that are unemployed out of our 160,000 employees in the food service industry. So we have to start to figure out a way to get these people back to work, get these businesses up and running. And that's really all our messaging has been to the public health sector, say, hey, we also want to follow some other states and look at those guidelines, which we put forward to Paul. Is, you know, a week and a half ago, we unveiled the Connecticut Restaurant Promise, taking to heart some other states and put together best practices and things that we are going to continue to do through this pandemic to continue to protect our employees and our customers.
Scott Dolch heads the Connecticut Restaurant Association. He is the guest here on a Monday Connecticut Today at 5:12. Scott, what about what the governor alluded to, and you just did a couple of seconds ago, that not all these restaurants are even remotely, some of them are, there's some in my area, but a lot of these restaurants either don't have or have very limited areas for outdoor dining because they only do it on a seasonal basis, late spring, summer, and early fall. And there are also local ordinances, Scott, people should know, with, you know, setup of tables on sidewalks, parking lots, consuming liquor outside. How are your members going to get help with this?
Well, I think, you know, it's got to start with the administration and the governor, and we've had that conversation, and we're very appreciative that we've been a part of that conversation with his team to say, listen, we need help from the state first before, you know, having to manage and deal with 169 towns individually. And they've understood that. I think that the good thing is I've gotten a lot of outreach from first selectmen and mayors out there across the state saying, how can we help? We want to get our restaurants back up and running. You know, can we, you know, shut down, you know, roads and sidewalks and parking lots. But obviously there's a lot of moving parts, as you can imagine. And we're trying to work through that as we move forward to this May 20th date. You know, we're hopeful that the governor's office is going to put something out in the next day or two. I know David Lehman alluded to that on Friday. And we're just working through that with the municipalities, because there's a lot of moving parts. But the good thing is, I do think everyone understands, you know, we want to get restaurants that have patios, maybe to expand it. Those that don't have patios, is there an option for them? And but at the same time, still understanding, and, you know, it's a business decision for every restaurant whether they reopen and the costs that are associated. And that kind of goes back to the, you know, looking at indoor and outdoor and following these strict social distancing guidelines, which we want to do. But, you know, if someone that doesn't have patio furniture, doesn't have the umbrellas, you know, to take on that expense, mm-hmm. is also a risk, you know, that they're going to look at as well. So I think that those all play into the factors of what we're looking for and trying to help our industry any way that we can.
Scott, you and I have talked about this before when it comes to things like, you know, the 20-80 rule and the minimum wage rule. Even the best restaurants, Scott, operate on small margins. Even the places that have been in neighborhoods for years, they do great volume, but the margins are very competitive. I saw a figure, you've probably seen this too, even though they're good, something like 70 or 80% of restaurants go out of business within 5 or 10 years. So you're asking an industry to come back here with reservations that's difficult to begin with. I mean, it's almost like a heavyweight fighter going into a title fight, you know, with one bad leg. I don't know how a lot of these places are going to do it.
Well, no, Paul, I love the analogy. I think it's so true for people to understand our industry, that they're working on a national average is a 3 to 5% profit margin. So every dollar that's coming in, you know, the profit margin is 3 to 5 cents. So what they're dealing with, what these restaurants have been dealing with since March 16th, you know, and how much it has impacted and what their risks are and how, you know, the stress level and every conversation is saying, hey, we got to get them back on their feet. But the road to recovery is going to be extremely long, you know, to say, hey, once we get the doors back open, you know, there's so much more to this that we've said to the governor's office, and they've listened, that, you know, this is going to be, you know, at best case, a 6 to 10 month recovery. But we're probably looking much longer than that. And to help these local businesses that do so much for their communities, we have to find creative ways to help them, not just in reopening plans, but also, you know, other support that can be out there to help their businesses on a federal and state level.
And we're spending a few more minutes here with Scott Dolch, who's head of the Connecticut Restaurant Association, as we now have a target date, just 10 days from now, a week from this coming Wednesday, to get things up and running, at least partially. I'm sorry, 9 days from now. Get things up and running partially, at least with Connecticut's restaurants. Scott, you know, I was talking a little earlier before I had you on, and set aside the economic impact that your great member restaurants have on the state, from, you know, a chain all the way down to a mom and pop coffee shop. I think part of the reason people want back in to eat, and part of the reason that your member places are so vital, is that where we go to eat, oftentimes, Scott, the food is something we expect, and that's often the second or third most important thing we go to, that we worry about when we go to restaurants like the ones that you represent. It's the camaraderie, it's the gathering place, it's the sense of community that restaurants give to areas, whether it's a little coffee shop or somebody going out for a first date or a date night with a, every week with a husband or a wife, whatever. That's another aspect, I think, Scott, that's lost in this whole debate about eating out.
I couldn't agree with you more, Paul. I think that, you know, this I guess, new normal we've been in for the last 7 weeks, without having that opportunity to go out to your local restaurant in whatever capacity, business, pleasure, family, you know, that's obviously, it means so much to people. And like you said, secondary, it's the experience that you have, and nothing can take away from that experience people can have, you know, in a restaurant. And that's what we're trying to get back to. And obviously we want to do it safely. We want people to feel confident that when they go into that restaurant, you know, through our promise and everything else, that they're going to be protected and their employees are going to be protected. But, you know, I also make the joke with a lot of folks as well is, you know, getting to the grocery store, and I am not one, even though I work for the industry, I'm great in the kitchen. So to be able to go and enjoy a meal that I didn't have to make or yeah. clean up, you know, you sometimes forget that sense of it too, of like, hey, I can, you know, I can be served, that customer service. We are a service industry. We're the leaders in that. And I think, you know, people are definitely hoping to get back to that sooner rather than later and start that part of our economy and our feeling of I guess, normal life again. When you start to see these doors, you know, on the outside, at least open up on May 20th to start to see some people, you know, just going to see a friend that maybe you haven't seen face to face or in person in 7 weeks that you maybe saw, you know, a lot during the normal time. So all of that plays into it. And I think that we're hopeful, mm-hmm. you know, that people will start to feel comfortable to get back into these businesses and support them because, you know, nothing takes away from that.
You talked about a gradual 6 to 8 to 10 month reboot to hopefully get things back to something close of where they were. But there's got to be some worry on your part, Scott, and your organization and organizations like yours across the country that not everyone's going to make it here. I mean, that's kind of the reality, Scott, isn't it?
It absolutely is, Paul. It's been, you know, people are like, well, Scott, you know, you're everywhere doing so much. And I always say every day I wake up, I'm fortunate because the restaurateurs, since the moment they were asked to shut down or told to shut down, you know, it was the hardest day they've ever faced. People that have had restaurants 30 or 40 years having to look their family, their employees in the eye and say, hey, to keep this, hopefully that it can reopen for you, I have to make this decision by unfortunately laying you off. And my concern is every business that doesn't make it, it makes me lose sleep at night. And how do I can help, you know, every call that I get of their concern or financially how they're going to make it or what they can do, or I've never done takeout before, Scott, how can I get creative or with my menu or whatever that it might be. I mean, we are trying to be that resource to them, but it's a reality that I know we're going to face. I hope the percentage that can't make it or mm-hmm. is lower than I think. But you know, we're going to, you know, time is going to tell, as we start to move through this. But I tell everybody that I talk to is, you know, supporting your restaurant right now makes a huge difference. I can't stress enough, going to do takeout and curbside and keeping them afloat. It's keeping some people on staff. It's helping pay some of their bills. Like, it means so much to them. And I would, you know, continue to stress that now and until we get to the next phase and to the next phase, that, you know, you should feel good about, so you're supporting local, you're supporting a business that also supports how many other ancillary businesses that are out there that rely on restaurants, you know, fishermen, farmers, to the distributors, all of that plays into this economy that we have to start to get back on its feet.
Scott, thank you. Be well. And as we move along in this process, we shall certainly be in touch. Scott, thanks. We appreciate it.
Paul, thank you so much for the time. And as always, hope you continue to support your local restaurants in your town and to your listeners as well. Thank you again.
Oh, Scott, trust me. I support many local restaurants. Trust me.
Thanks, Paul. We'll,
I'm a single guy with a microwave. You know I support restaurants. Thanks, Scott.
Well,
Scott Dolch.